welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
G'day listeners, welcome to LNL. I had hoped to make it a bright light night with Shapiro because I wanted to talk to him about the wonderful goings-on at the World Bank. Many of us, of course, remember Jimmy Wolfenson's arrival there. We were very proud when an Australian became the bank manager, and we closed our accounts at ANZ and Westpac and opened little savings accounts at the World Bank. I applied for a home loan. Didn't get it for some reason. But imagine my shock and horror when Wolfenson is replaced by Wolfowitz, who's now been caught with his hand in the till, and I wanted to talk to Bruce about that and whether we should all cancel our accounts. For instance, should I cut up my American Express card issued by the World Bank? But with the appalling and horrifying and overwhelmingly depressing events of Virginia Tech, I'm sure that's what Bruce will want to talk about. And in a strange and sad way, it will link with our second story, because what is a rare occurrence in the United States of America is a daily, sometimes hourly occurrence in Baghdad. And we'll be looking at imperial life in the Emerald City, inside Baghdad's Green Zone, with Rajiv Chandrasekaran. And I have to tell you, this bloke can write. Not all writers can write. A lot of them push words around as though they were cold porridge. But I read Rajiv's compelling account of what it's actually like to dwell within the Green Zone, particularly before it was so skillfully gate-crashed by the suicide bomber. But he'll be coming on a little later in the program. Let's whiz over to talk to Bruce Shapiro from The Nation on what is a tragic day for America. And that tragedy, I have to tell you, Bruce, resonates across this country as well.
Well, I'm sure it does, and has perhaps particular resonance for those with a connection to the Port Arthur shootings. This is the worst single mass shooting in American history, a country which is no stranger to the gun, and after Columbine and other incidents, no stranger to collective violence. But this has a special chilling effect because, of course, so many of the victims are university students. People are thinking back to the last famous university shooting in the 1960s, when a fellow stood with a rifle in the tower at the University of Boston and shot down on the crowd, but over the course of 90 minutes or so. But the other challenging issue with this emerging story is that so much is unknown. Only an hour ago did the university, Virginia Tech, even say they got an ID on the shooter, and we still don't have his name. They believe it's a student who was a resident of one of the dorms. It appears at this hour to have been a case of intimate violence, someone whose girlfriend had broken up with him, which then escalated into this horrific tragedy. Two separate shootings over the course of several hours. There are questions about whether there was adequate police protection and so on, but I think the overwhelming question, which will surface once the initial search for facts and the initial grief is passed, is how it was that a young student, clearly emotionally disturbed, managed to acquire and wield a couple of handguns in such spectacularly deadly fashion.
Well, your president has predictably muttered the appropriate pieties, but also his spokesperson makes it clear that this is not going to be seen as any reason to review your gun laws.
Well, the nation's gun laws are largely decided state by state, and we will see what happens with the culture of guns in the aftermath of this. I should say that politically, up until now, there has not in the last few years been much motivation to talk about guns. In fact, in general, the Democrats, in their perpetual quest to remake a majority that includes big parts of the South and that includes gun-wielding males and everything else, the Democrats have largely backed off their earlier strong advocacy of gun control, though there are exceptions to that. It's sort of dropped off the radar. I think that this incident will single-handedly raise it for a little while. We'll see whether it has any long-term impact.
But you've got 200 million guns in circulation, haven't you, in the U.S.?
Not only do you have 200 million guns, but what you have are a variety of rules and regulations in every state governing how easy or difficult it is to get them. And Virginia, I should say, has historically been one of the relatively wide open gun marketplaces. It's easy to get guns in Virginia, and indeed, during the heyday of urban gun violence in the Northeast in the 1980s, Virginia was typically the supply point for crack gangs and gun suppliers in New York, Boston, and points north.
So there might be a reassessment in Virginia. As you know, after Port Arthur, our Prime Minister, and, you know, I put it on public record at the time, did something which was quite remarkable, and that is, despite long traditions of conservatism, particularly amongst farming folk who feel that they are entitled to have guns in much the same way that the American Constitution allows. As you know, he campaigned for a mass hand-in of guns. And, it was fairly controversial, but the Australians sort of fronted up to their police stations with the most remarkable armoury, and there was thousands and thousands and thousands of guns were crushed and melted down.
Well, it will be interesting to see what happens. I mean, Blacksburg, where Virginia Tech is, a couple of clicks to the west of Roanoke, is in the heart of the Appalachian South. It is right where Virginia, West Virginia, East Tennessee, North Carolina all come together, an area of mountains, an area of great linguistic and musical traditions, an area as well that has a kind of a strong gun tradition. So we'll see what happens.
Bruce, I was looking at the Lehrer Hour tonight, and they flashed a graphic up on the screen which showed that, which purported to show that the way it plays out in American public opinion, this is prior to Virginia, is that only a small percentage of people see guns as the issue. A majority of people blame these events on poor parenting, and an almost equal number blame it on media and video games. But guns themselves were only seen as the problem by about 20%.
Well, look, we very much have two cultures when it comes to guns. There's a kind of urban-suburban culture which says that guns are the problem. And then there's a big part of the country that's either rural or, in fact, just nuts that doesn't see guns as the problem. But I think in this case, both of those issues, parenting or, in this case, the in loco parentis role of the university, and media are certainly going to play out. The whole Roanoke area has become a kind of a media circus, and there will be, I'm sure, people who will take out a lot of resentment on the media. The university itself may have made some significant errors in the course of this thing. It appears that after the
By not having the lockdown or the...
Well, whether it was a lockdown or not, it certainly sounded from last night's press conference as if after the initial shootings were reported, there were not a lot of attempts to find a killer who was still at large, a general sense that they could write it off, he was off campus and they wouldn't be able to find him. That, I think, will turn out to cost a person or two their jobs. But look, the other issue here, and it can't be underestimated, is that there's a lot of intimate violence on college campuses. And I think that perhaps will rise.
Run that past me again. There's a lot of what violence?
A lot of domestic violence, a lot of intimate violence, a lot of threats and high emotions among couples. And this is a hidden issue. I got an interesting insight into this actually just a couple of weeks ago after I returned from visiting you. I arrived back at my office at the University of Washington on the same day that a former student and current university employee was shot to death by her ex-boyfriend on campus. Not that there's some epidemic of shootings of ex-girlfriends, but the police at the University of Washington said, and I have since confirmed this, that it's quite common to get threats reported. And I think there's a lot of fear on college campuses now, I know, about copycat shootings and escalating emotions in the wake of it.
But this copycat phenomenon is so very pop cultural and American, isn't it? That we've always known that suicide has a copycat dimension. And as you know, for decades, newspapers, media did not report suicide unless it was absolutely inescapable or unavoidable, because there was a sense of caution that one might lead to another. But surely, heavens, you know, campus massacres have become a fashion.
Well, we're still not quite there yet, but I think there's no doubt that in a media-saturated culture, when somebody wants to make a big statement, when whatever it is that's driving them emotionally leads them to want to make a big statement, they look at the kind of things that get attention. And certainly Columbine High School got attention, as the Oklahoma City bombing did before that. And I think that this is in that same tradition of someone who is on a personally destructive trajectory that becomes a socially destructive trajectory. And then that plays out socially and politically.
And let's face it, there may also be very subtle connections with the phenomenon of terrorism. This is another form of terrorism. And I've had people on the program who have argued, I think quite plausibly, that very often the suicide bomber is someone who is entirely dysfunctional, who legitimizes his psychopathology, if you like, by making it political, by making it, religious.
And I think there's two sides to that. One is that the individual legitimizes it, and the other is that the movement, the campaign, the organization understands that there are vulnerable and disturbed individuals, and these people become the foot soldiers in the cause. The question is not, are there disturbed individuals out there capable of great destructive behavior? Of course there are. We are a destructive species, for one thing. But there are also individuals with huge destructive capacities. The issue is, what are the weapons available to them? What are the forms of social organization or legitimacy available to them, and so on?
And how much oxygen of publicity is available to them, too?
Well, indeed, although it's hard to argue that if someone, shoots up a college campus and kills 30 people, or as happens daily in Baghdad, 33 people get killed in a bombing. I mean, this is a familiar number to us.
I'm not advocating censorship, but it is certainly an ingredient in the multifactorial equation.
Well, and it's a question of how the story gets told. And I think actually one of the big questions to come out of Virginia Tech that we should pay attention to is how the story ends up being told, how American society comes to understand what is at once a peculiar, terrible, individual tragedy involving the killer and involving the victims, and also something with probably some significant implications beyond.
Well, the kids themselves have been doing quite a good job, haven't they?
They have. Some of the best coverage has come from the Collegiate Times, the newspaper on the Virginia Tech campus. They've even braved some really serious interactions with the police early in the day yesterday, when there was a report, accurate as it turned out, that the shooter was an Asian American male. A photographer for the student newspaper was tackled and handcuffed by police. There are pictures of this, and he brushed himself off afterward and continued taking his pictures after he was correctly identified as an innocent bloke. So, and of course, this is a very challenging story for the students. These are their friends. This is their own community. And they are rising to the occasion along with the local and the more responsible of the national media that are covering this.
Mm. And, of course, you're involved in this through the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma, aren't you?
Well, involved. I mean, many of the journalists who've worked with us, some of them are covering the story, and others are putting together, including some Australian colleagues, actually, putting together a little package of ideas and advice for American news organizations that are going to cover this in the long run, based on what we've learned from Port Arthur, from Columbine, from other mass atrocities along those lines, whether in the workplace, the school, or the street.
Mm. Look, before I let you go, let's just do a minute or so, if you wouldn't mind, on the Wolfowitz story, because I do find it delicious.
Stop reading my mind.
I mean, what a twit to let himself get caught up in.
What's remarkable about it, other than sheer entertainment value, is that, in fact, the same arrogance and the same lack of sense of consequence and the same unwillingness to tell the truth, which marked the entry into the Iraq War, which Wolfowitz was a key architect of, mark this otherwise minor scandal. It's interesting. What is emerging is that not only did Wolfowitz pressure the World Bank bureaucracy to promote and give a raise to his companion, he also then lied about it to the bank's board and regulators. There's a lot of evidence that he really underplayed his role. This is of a piece in its own curious little way with the man who lied about weapons of mass destruction and the man who led a delusional president and a delusional administration into a war on delusional premises. This is the guy now in charge of financing the developing world's economic growth. Not a happy prospect.
Bruce, good to talk to you. Bruce Shapiro from The Nation, our bloke in Washington. And before I identify the program and introduce my next guest, whom I've been looking forward to talking to for a little while, I want to mark the passing of a very, very fine Australian actor, Justine Saunders. Justine, an Aboriginal woman, was a formidable actor. And I suddenly remembered, when I heard about her sad death, a remarkable night at the Cannes Film Festival. She was one of the stars of a film called The Fringe Dwellers, directed by my old colleague and collaborator, Bruce Beresford. And I went to the opening night in the great big Cannes cinema with everyone in their long dresses and their dicky suits for the what was effectively the world premiere. And there's Justine and the other Aboriginal actors being feted, being clapped, cheered to the rafters because it wasn't a bad film. But the strange thing was there was another group of Australian Aborigines attending. They also had been freighted over on government airline tickets, but they were not there to clap and cheer Justine and the others. They were there to boo and abuse them. They were there to accuse them of Uncle Tomism, and even being involved in the film. And I remember the pain that Justine suffered that night and the great confusion, because there they were, so proud of what they'd done as a group of Aboriginal actors in what was and remains a very intriguing film, but to be loudly condemned in their hour of triumph by fellow Aborigines, it's something I've never been able to forget. Late Night Live, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. And as we've promised you, we're now going from the massacre on campus in Virginia to a place where 30, 40, 50 people and more die, it would seem, every other hour. I talk, of course, of the Emerald City, one of the pseudonyms for Baghdad. as I was saying at the beginning of the program, not every writer can write, but I'm going to tell you, my next guest writes like an angel. I was reading an extract from his book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Baghdad's Green Zone, a week or so ago, and said we've got to get him on the program. Little did I realise how utterly appropriate his arrival on our little show would be on this occasion. I want to look at just one attack last week in Baghdad. It reaped a lesser death toll than Virginia, but it had a disproportionately large impact because, as you'll recall, the bomb was detonated inside the Iraqi Parliament building within Baghdad's heavily protected security zone. And a statement on the website of a group calling itself the Islamic State of Iraq put it bluntly: a knight from the State of Islam reached the heart of the Green Zone and blew himself up amongst a gathering of the infidel masters. Now, it's not the first, but it has to be the most significant attack within the Green Zone, which is a section of Baghdad, home to government, military officials, et al., surrounded by concrete blast walls. My next guest has written a definitive account of the Green Zone, and later in our chat I want to get him to describe this absolutely surreal place, with all its luxuries and its opulence and its total sort of hermetically sealed contrast with the world outside it. But first of all, we've got to look at this event and its significance. We're talking about the hub of the coalition war effort in Iraq, this American cocoon within the nightmare of post-war Iraq. And it's all there in Imperial Life in the Emerald City. Rajiv Chandrasekharan now joins me from his home in Washington, D.C. And, of course, he can write. Heavens above, he's assistant managing editor at the Washington Post and a former Baghdad bureau chief. Rajiv, welcome to our little program.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be on with you, and thank you for that very kind introduction. I dare say you flatter me too much.
Well, I have to tell you, I have a great many guests to whom one is equally polite, but it's sometimes a bit of a struggle, Rajiv, because they're not that good, and you are. So let's, before we get into that detailed account of life in the Green Zone as it was, I understand the bomb last week was detonated inside a cafeteria reserved for parliamentarians and gophers.
That's correct.
How difficult would it have been for a bomber to get in?
Well, you know, it probably wasn't that difficult. These days, the Green Zone has really broken into a lot of mini Green Zones amalgamated together instead of one unitary part of Baghdad. It really is a confederation of mini security zones. So there's the area around the U.S. Embassy that has its own walls and guards, and the area around other American installations inside there. But the areas that are inhabited by Iraq's leadership, because keep in mind, the Iraqi prime minister, many members of his cabinet live and work inside the Green Zone because it is far more secure than other parts of Iraq, or at least it will. Even after this bombing, it still is. And the parliament building is also located inside the Green Zone. But in those Iraqi-dominated enclaves of the Green Zone, it's Iraqis who have largely taken charge of security.
And the So great big seven-foot Americans are not standing there,
at least in the entrances to those specific Iraqi areas. And so what happens is, if somebody's wearing a badge that identifies themselves as a member of parliament or a bodyguard of a member or an aide, many cases they get whisked through with a very perfunctory search. And so there are vulnerabilities, and it would appear that the suicide bomber in this case exploited one of those vulnerabilities. It's not clear whether they were really a guard of one of the members of parliament, or they used a stolen badge, or exactly.
So it could have been an inside job, or it could have had a degree of inside help, but it's not that difficult.
Exactly.
Although I understand that the protocols include full body searches, dog sniffing for explosives, electronic vehicle scanners, etc.
They do, and those protocols exist for entry into, well, if you're taking a car, I think all of those protocols would apply. I think that they've just relaxed some of them in recent months around the Parliament building. But certainly if you were trying to go to one of the more American-controlled parts of the Green Zone these days, you would be subjected to at least two or three body searches. All of your goods would be x-rayed. You would be sniffed for explosives. All of those sorts of things certainly would be used.
Okay. Now, this bombing, which killed one parliamentarian, a Mohammed Awad, a Sunni member of the moderate National Dialogue Front, is a political catastrophe back home in Washington, is it not?
Yes, because the Bush administration's current plan for Iraq, this so-called troop surge, is based upon the belief that if you create security in Baghdad, then the political leadership will come together, the parliament in particular will come together, and act on some important legislative measures aimed at promoting national reconciliation, such as the oil law, de-Ba'athification, and other initiatives. Well, if your parliament cafeteria has been blown up and your parliamentarians now feel too scared to come to work, it raises some very big questions.
Look, if it happened in Canberra, Rajiv, there wouldn't be the same desperate chase after pre-selection for our political parties. It's not a nice thought.
Certainly isn't. I think that if you look at what the impact of this bombing will be, I think that over time it will be seen to be fairly significant. Remember, look, only one person was killed here. But if you go back and you remember the bombing of the Golden Dome Shrine in Samarra,
yep,
which helped to fuel a wave of sectarian killings in Iraq, nobody was killed in that bombing. It's an interesting irony in all of this that those bombings that sometimes kill 100 people, they actually wind up being less strategically significant than these bombings that don't kill as many people but are aimed at particularly symbolic targets, like a shrine or, in this case, like the Parliament building.
I suddenly recall, and I'm sure you will too, events of a few years ago when the IRA lobbed at least one, I think it was two, mortar shells in the close vicinity of No. 10 Downing Street. And once again, no one was hurt or injured, but boy, did that create a kerfuffle.
I think a big part of what the insurgents in Iraq are trying to do is to sow terror, to breed fear. And I think they realize that if they go after the nexus of power, they go after the political leadership, that creates more fear than simply bombing a market.
Rajiv, take us back to the beginning of the occupation and the establishment of the Green Zone, because it really was Saddam Hussein's creation, wasn't it?
Indeed it was. It wasn't called the Green Zone back then, but back when Saddam was in power, he wanted to create a whole neighborhood that would be cut off from the rest of Baghdad for his ministers, his cronies, his bodyguards, so that they could live without being influenced, perhaps, by ordinary Iraqis. And so he carved out this whole swath of central Baghdad around the Republican Palace that became known as the Presidential Zone. Back then, it didn't have concrete walls or barbed wire, but Iraqis knew that it was Saddam's people inside, and in fact, drivers would speed when they were driving near there because they didn't want to get accused of gawking by the walls of the palace.
Yeah. So it was the ideal place for the Americans to pitch their tents.
It was. The Americans were looking for a place that would have some space to it, that would have at least significant barriers. They didn't want to be right up against a busy street. To the Americans who were involved in looking just in terms of security, it seemed to make the most sense. But to the other Americans involved in the Reconstruction effort, those who cared more about how things looked politically and symbolically, it was a grave mistake because, they thought, there's no worse message than setting yourself up in a palace of the tyrant.
Mm.
But their views were trumped by the people who are responsible for protecting Americans, what they call the force protection people.
And of course, the Americans expand on the on Saddam's palace precinct, don't they? Because you say they've turned it into a 10 square kilometre area of downtown, which includes the convention centre, now the Iraqi Parliament building, and the Al Rashid Hotel.
Yes, they expanded it a bit to encompass other nearby buildings that they wanted to have inside the green zone. They built up the walls. It wasn't just the brick walls of Saddam Hussein's days. It was these big, thick, 17-foot-high concrete blast walls topped with barbed wire. They positioned tanks at the gates. And then, most significantly, Philip, they transformed the inside. They turned the inside into, quite frankly, a little America. It became a bubble that was cut off from the rest of Iraq.
Well, let's deal with that now, because this was the first piece of yours I read, and I was gobsmacked. I had no idea of the totality of the cultural transplant. Paint a picture for us of that world inside the U.S. Green Zone.
Well, let's start first with the cafeteria. You would think that if you were in the middle of Iraq, you might be eating kebab and hummus and some flatbread. But inside the Green Zone, the food was always American. It was hamburgers and grilled cheese sandwiches. And to make matters worse, you know, many Muslims find pork to be an offensive food product. And there were many Iraqi Muslims who worked inside the Green Zone as janitors, as drivers, or as translators. And they were carefully vetted by the Americans to ensure that there were no bad elements, or at least none they thought of. And they were forced to eat from the same cafeteria. So what did Halliburton, the American defense contractor, manage
the
to get?
The listeners are very aware of Halliburton, I promise you, Rajiv.
Yeah. So what did Halliburton manage to get into the meals? Some form of pork, bacon for breakfast, hot dogs for lunch. To me, that was just so surreal.
Oh,
then they filled up the swimming pools. They established at least six bars. There was a disco. There were gymnasiums. If you were bored, you could go for salsa dancing lessons. There were Bible study classes. It was so cut off from the real Iraq that one night in September 2003, they actually held an Iraqi culture night so that people inside the Green Zone could be exposed to the culture of the country they were supposedly living in.
Heavens above. Now, in contrast, you chose to live in the Red Zone across the river. Did the Red Zone refer to anywhere that wasn't the Green Zone?
Exactly, yes. So to the people inside the Green Zone, the whole rest of Iraq was the Red Zone, the big bad country out there.
Yeah. So you lived in a decrepit Ishtar Sheraton Hotel.
I did, with many other journalists, because after a while that became one of the few safer places to live. Before that, we were fortunate enough to live in a house in an Iraqi neighborhood near Baghdad University, and it was lovely. I had Iraqi neighbors. I went to the markets to buy food. Back then, in 2003, Baghdad wasn't that dangerous. You know, the Americans who lived in the Green Zone could have gotten out and about. They could have gone to local restaurants. They could have visited Iraqis in their homes more. But they chose to remain sequestered inside the Green Zone.
I want to point out the differences between red and green. And this is, I'm quoting you to you. At this decrepit Sheraton Hotel, the room service was so abysmal, we had to install our own kitchen, four burner gas stove, a chest freezer, and a meat grinder. And in one of the rooms, I drove around without a security detail, ate at local restaurants, visited Iraqis in their own homes. And so incredulous American officials from the Green Zone would say to you, "What's it like out there?"
You know, I felt like a Martian describing life on another planet to people back in the Green Zone.
It sounds a bit like an episode of The Truman Show, doesn't it?
It does indeed. It was this whole separate, world where things worked. It was this kind of idyllic environment where, you know, everybody drove around in these large sport utility vehicles, Chevrolet Suburbans that had been brought in by Halliburton. They all obeyed the speed limit. There was electricity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. All the buildings were nicely air-conditioned. On the outside, it was chaotic. People would wait in miles-long lines for petrol. There were, they were lucky to get 4 or 5 hours of electricity a day. And so, yes, it felt otherworldly inside. But it wasn't, to some degree, I understand the need for Americans and for Brits and the Australians who were there to have a place that had some comforts of home.
One isn't critical of that. That's a deep psychological need. But I was fascinated by your revelations about the degree of segregation within, even amongst the what you describe as the tribes of the coalition of the willing. They tended to segregate themselves.
That they did. And it was, there were the Americans and there were the Brits and the Aussies, and then there were the other European partners, the Poles and the Romanians. And even among the Americans, they segregated. They were the young, very conservative, true believers in President Bush and the Republican Party. There were some older, gray-haired, former diplomats who were out for one last taste of adventure. There were some middle-aged contractors who were simply there, I think, to try to make an extra buck or two. It was a whole interesting assortment of people. An anthropologist could have had a field day with life inside.
Well, you've had a field day with it. You've become an anthropologist yourself. And I note with interest that there were Pakistanis and Indians to cook, serve and clean, I guess that Iraqis weren't too trusted in the kitchens.
That's right. The Halliburton and the American generals that ran the place feared that the Iraqis might poison the food. So they first and foremost did not purchase any food from Iraq. I mean, everything was trucked in, the milk, the tomatoes, the salad greens, all of it was brought in from other parts of the Persian Gulf or at some points flown in from America. And they wouldn't trust Iraqis to actually cook or serve the food. They brought in legions of Pakistanis, of Indians, and Filipinos to do all of that work.
And the Iraqis who queued up to get into the green zone each day had to pretend they weren't working for the Americans.
In many cases, that's very correct, because they risked being killed if they were known to be collaborators. So they would make up stories in many cases. They would say, well, we have to go to the green zone because the Americans have detained one of our relatives and we must go and find them. Or they would make up stories so that the taxi drivers, so that the family members and others wouldn't know what they really did.
Rajiv, I remember on my first trip to Beijing, and as you probably know, Australia was one of the first countries to sign up for the recognition of the mainland Chinese regime. I remember visiting our embassy, and the ambassador was a decent fellow. He was a member of of the Country Party, which is a conservative rural party, or was then. But he was quite a Chinese scholar. But I met Australians who were working in the embassy, who'd been on a tour of duty there for 2 or 3 years, who had never left the compound, who'd never shown enough curiosity just to go to downtown Beijing. Did you find people in the green zone who behaved as ludicrously as that? In other words, stayed in those walls?
Oh, most certainly. I met a young man from my own same hometown in Northern California. We actually connected up because both of our mothers had met at the same food shop back home, and they exchanged our email addresses. And so I contacted this young man who was a good, loyal Republican, a political appointee who had come to the Green Zone to do some work for Ambassador Paul Bremer. And he had been in the Green Zone at that point when we first met for, I think, upwards of 3 months, perhaps 4 months. And he had been outside just once, and that was to go to another American base. And when I told him that I lived outside the Green Zone and I lived among Iraqis and went to shops and markets and restaurants, he was incredulous. He couldn't comprehend that. And first he was just a little kind of worried for me, like, isn't that dangerous? Why are you doing that? And then when I explained to him that at least back then it was wasn't so dangerous and that I was able to really experience all these things that he couldn't inside the Green Zone, he became a bit jealous.
Now, given your name, Rajiv Chandrasekharan, I suspect that you were not born totally white. Did your own ethnicity make it easier for you to move around Baghdad?
You know, that's a very good question. It did. My family's from India, but I was born and raised in California. But given that I'm of a darker skin complexion, you know, I on a good day look like a dark-skinned guy from Basra. And so I was able to drive around, and if I kept my mouth shut and I was wearing some Iraqi clothing, people really didn't do a double take when I went by. It made it much easier to get around the country than a light-skinned Westerner.
But you did a double take when you started to confront the sort of people who were recruited to the Green Zone by Halliburton or the Defense Department or the State Department or whoever. Would you be kind enough to tell your Australian listeners about Michael Cole, Halliburton's customer service liaison?
He was a young man, barely out of college, who had been working on an office in the U.S. Congress when he got an offer to work for Halliburton as its customer service manager in the Green Zone. And what that meant was when people had trouble, like their trailer was leaky or they wanted a different sort of food in the canteen, or they wanted to watch a particular movie in the Palace Cinema, they would come and see him, and he would very politely say, well, we will work on that. You know, he was like a hotel concierge. And it was so bizarre to think that they actually had one of these things in the Green Zone, but
how he was recruited.
But
how he was recruited, I find very amusing. He's been out of college for less than a year. He's working as a junior aide to a Republican congressman from Virginia. A Halliburton vice president overhears him talking to friends in Arlington about his dealings with irate constituents, and that's enough to get him the job.
It was. And, you know, it's probably worth mentioning how the hiring process worked in many cases, because you would think, given the challenges of reconstructing and governing post-Saddam Iraq, the United States government would have sent its very best and brightest. But instead, quite frankly, in many cases, our government sent the loyal and the willing. You know, people were not chosen because they spoke Arabic, because they had some experience in the Middle East or skills in post-conflict nation building. Instead, in many cases, the chief criteria seemed to be political loyalty. So they recruited people not from the State Department or from non-governmental organizations, but from Republican offices on Capitol Hill, from conservative think tanks in Washington. And just to make sure they got people who were sufficiently loyal, they subjected them to some very blunt questioning at the Pentagon before they were allowed to fly off to Baghdad. People were asked questions like, are you a member of the Republican Party? Did you vote for George W. Bush in the 2000 election?
Have you accepted Christ as your own personal savior? Things like this.
And some people have even told me that they were asked for their views about abortion.
Right. Oh, dear. Tell us about Jay Helen and how this 24-year-old came to be given the job. I'm sorry about laughing. Reopening the Baghdad Stock Exchange.
An incredibly galling story. Jay Helen, as you say, 24 years old, had graduated from college 2 years earlier, had never worked in the financial sector in the United States, but was a good young Republican, had applied for a job at the White House, apparently had some family connections to the Republican Party, and he found himself in Baghdad with the sole responsibility of reopening Baghdad Stock Exchange. And instead of working with the Iraqis to quickly reopen the exchange as they had run it before the war. Of course, it wasn't the world's most modern exchange. They used some blackboards and some chits of paper, but it worked. We're not talking about billion-dollar market capitalizations here. But young Jay Helen determined that he didn't want to open the market until they had computerized everything, until they had built an American-style Securities and Exchange Commission. Meanwhile, the Iraqi traders were simply saying, let us get back to work. People want their money. We want to at least get back to doing what we were doing before. And instead, Jay Helen put his foot down, and the stock exchange stayed closed for more than a year.
Mm. Mind you, he was well prepared. He was sent to an army base in Virginia for a training session. He got two immunizations and a flak jacket. That's pretty good.
Indeed. That was about the extent of the training a lot of people received, about a half day. And this was, you know, back in late 2003,
heavens,
when we had pretty much determined there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They were still giving, you know, the training, the much of it focused on how to use your gas mask.
Now, the hopeless failure of post-war planning is all too familiar to us, as are the turf and the ideological disputes between the Pentagon and state over the control of reconstruction and so on. But which examples stick out in your mind as the worst, the most egregious? I'm thinking, perhaps I'm prompting here, but Jay Garner.
Well, you know, Jay Garner was in over his head, but he was a well-meaning individual. And, you know, Garner was given no resources to do the job. The important work the State Department had done before the invasion, the Future of Iraq project, this ambitious effort to work with Iraqis in exile to figure out what needed to be done to help stand up a government, to deal with the reconstruction of Iraq's infrastructure, etc. None of those reports were provided to Jay Garner. Garner had a very small staff. He was never given any clear guidance about how to engage in the political transition in Iraq. And he was not a man who had really specialized in these post-conflict environments. But I think this was all intentional. I think that the Pentagon wanted Garner to go there without much of a plan, because they hoped that the Iraqi exiles, most notably Ahmed Chalabi, would exploit this kind of chaotic environment and rise to be the new leader. And so I think part of this was all intentional. Well, of course, Chalabi didn't rise. He was a spectacular failure. And then the failure, the lack of a plan, meant that the one guy they thought might be the leader, you know, with him out of the picture, they had no plan B.
I've just opened your book at page 93, and I've underlined a sentence which I found particularly interesting. Let me read it. It didn't take long for the experts to conclude that more than 6,600 foreign police advisors should be sent to Iraq immediately. The White House dispatched one, Bernie Kerik. Tell us a little about Bernie.
Yeah, this is an amazing story. Bernie Kerik was the former police commissioner in New York during the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and he quickly became a national hero. And after that, he found himself sent to Iraq to take charge of rebuilding Iraq's police force. But Bernie Kerik really was not interested in doing the hard work of trying to vet the members of the Interior Ministry for ties to militia groups to actually train a real police force in Iraq. He was more interested in doing television interviews.
At $10,000 a pop on the public lecture circuit.
Well, that was before he came to Iraq. But when he got to Iraq, it was these interviews, but I'm sure they helped him sell some copies of his book. So it was, you know, all beneficial for him. And then it was to go on these sort of showy raids with some you know, Iraqi counterparts and a bunch of television cameras in tow to make it look like they were knocking down doors and catching the bad guys. Well, it made for good TV, but at the end of the day, what it meant was that the Americans were losing some very precious time in trying to build Iraqi police forces, and we are still dealing with the aftermath of the episode today.
So I didn't mean to interrupt, but you also found some people that were at least tried mightily, people that one has to admire, and I'm thinking of John Agresto's efforts to revive the universities.
Indeed, and I tried to take note of quite a number of people who went there and really thought and worked creatively to accomplish things in Iraq. And John Agresto is a great case. You know, on first glance, you would think Agresto was the wrong man for the job. Here was a guy who had run just a very small college before coming to Iraq. He was chosen largely because of his political connections. He was friends with Lynn Cheney, the wife of the vice president, and Joyce Rumsfeld, Donald Rumsfeld's wife, was on his board of directors for his college. But when he got out to Iraq, he began to act in a more pragmatic way. He really wanted to focus in on rebuilding universities in Iraq, but he quickly realized that the White House had not committed nearly enough money to the task of rebuilding, that his ability to go and visit universities and colleges was restricted because of the dangerous security situation. And eventually he came to conclude that the overall American mission was really doomed and was based on a lot of fundamental misconceptions. And a few days before he left Iraq for good in the summer of 2004, he and I were chatting by the pool behind the palace, and he was puffing on his pipe. And after about an hour of conversation, he turned to me and he said, "I feel like a neoconservative who's been mugged by reality."
Well, Paul Bremer was never successfully mugged by it, was it? You're absolutely relentless in your critique of him as a blundering tweet. I must say, on the front cover of the book, New York Times talks about your fine effort in terms of Catch-22, and Bremer seems to have this almost genius for being comically idiotic.
Well, I think he really found himself in over his head. Bremer was, again, I don't try to take issue with Bremer's intentions. I think he was a well-intentioned man, but he was, in some ways, a victim of the environment of the Green Zone. He was so cut off from the real Iraq, and he operated in this bubble that he wound up pursuing a lot of policies and initiatives that were just
new traffic code based on Maryland in the U.S. and the law protecting microchip designs when the city's in ruins.
It was this obsession with micromanagement and minutiae. Or, you know, the traffic code and the microchip design law are really funny and absurd, but let me give you one that's equally absurd but even more significant. And that is, you know, Iraq back in 2003 and 2004 had a lot of unemployed people. Unemployment was probably somewhere between 40% and 60%. So what would you expect the first wave of economic advisors to do? You know, perhaps create some jobs, focus in on employment programs, get disaffected young people off the streets and busy doing productive things. But instead, Bremer and his economic advisors said, one of our top priorities needs to be tax reform. And they went through and rewrote Iraq's tax code line by line.
And on that inspirational note, I must take my leave of you, Rajiv, because we're out of time. That was marvellous. It's a terrific book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Baghdad's Green Zone, by Rajiv Chandrasekaran. Thanks very much, Rajiv. On our next, Malaysian poet, political commentator Eden Koo gives us an update on Southeast Asian politics, and I'll be talking about the prospects for democracy in Zimbabwe with an inspiring young Zimbabwean politician. Oh, and more about the letters of Australian poet Judith Wright. Stick around, ABC Radio National, for the news. See you later.
ABC Radio National. on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.